Hi, this is Catherine Kutenbrauer. I'm going to read to you from my new novel, Perfecting. I've actually read the whole thing out loud a couple of times during the editorial process, but I've never read this bit publicly, so I thought I'd give it a try. Michael Dama felt the question rising in his gut and experienced it rippling through his scar tissue. Some of the old wounds had scarred into his body, and he could feel the pull of the web along his back ribs, like the damn things were gripping his skeleton. He had been shot a few times since that first time, and he had been aimed at so many times he had lost count. He heard the phone going like the whir of a rattlesnake. In his dreams that night, he'd been back home walking in bottomless lakes, daring his brother to go deeper off the trail. They'd been dropped off for the day by an oilman who had business out of Roswell, a pump that wasn't pumping good, as Michael recalled. They were going fishing, though they had no rods, nothing. In his dream, Michael jerked his legs away from that phantom snake so hard it woke him up and he was panting, reaching for a weapon, the dream waking into nightmare. Where was the damn rattlesnake? And where was he wondered, as the infernal buzzing shifted slowly to its rightful place, the telephone, his hotel telephone. Then how to stop it making that noise? He fumbled around and finally picked up the receiver. The digital clock read 3:17 a.m. Two gentlemen, to see you, sir. His eyes were already beginning to adjust to the filtered light. The bathroom switch had been left on, and a bar of light landed on the box. Early, he remembered thinking, they are early. Send them up the slow elevator. As you wish, sir. After a few minutes, Michael looked through the peephole and saw Omar with another man, a young man. They were fishbowled by the convex peep, making them look jowly and serious. He ought to have thought this strange, this Omar and a friend at his hotel room door, and he did, but not strange enough to hesitate in opening the door. He had his weapon, after all, and had let them into the room, the three of them standing crowded with the steel manpad case sitting there behind him. I wasn't expecting you, Omar. No, brother, you weren't, but I have come just the same. It was then he considered that Omar looked wrecked, that his eyes had an unnatural wetness. This is Khalid. He is my cousin. Nice to meet you. The word brother triggered something. The pleasure is mine. The man did not look at him. His eyes were downcast, sullen. My cousin wishes to make your acquaintance. I told him about you, and he wanted to meet you immediately. He has something to sell. Show him, Khalid. Khalid kept his eyes down, bent slightly, and tugged at the hem of his long beige chemise. Michael believed that this would be it. He expected the boy to be strapped with explosives and that this fast death would likely go unreported in the media. The shirt was fine linen, either new or expertly ironed. Michael reached out his hand and pressed down on the boy's arm. I am not buying anything now. You should go home, sleep, think about what you're doing. But the boy was persistent and brushed his hand away and continued to pull his shirt up. Michael wondered if his face showed fear. He was not really afraid. There was a point at which he felt relieved and another where he felt like laughing. Dying seemed to be a kind of joke. There were only two civilians who knew who he was and where he was, and only from the postmarks they deciphered stamped on packages he'd sent back to them. Iran, Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, wherever the fuck they sent him, wherever the fuck there was trouble, wherever they needed someone there, and also not there. It was the guns that told his contacts where he was. The guns knotted in intricate and sometimes garish threads on all those carpets he had rolled up and sent back home to Abi McCann. The instructions? Do not wash, do not sell. Or else, wash, sell for 200, buy your mother something nice. But it was almost 15 years before they heard from him at all, and 30 years all told, of Michael learning how to live inside a secret, how to be a secret. 15 years... 30 years. It slips by like a quiet river when you don't care about anything anymore. There had been one war, and then another. There had been false friendships, aliases, dumb code names, Otter, Romeo, and trading of information. It had all been a game, Michael manipulating pieces on a board that he cared about only superficially, as if humankind were truly made up of little plastic markers. People, individual people with families, were dying horrific deaths every day. That kind of witnessing might have tweaked him, had he had any stake in death, but he did not. Michael tried to convince himself of the ineptitude of his team, for this particular stance helped him in moments of moral questioning, moments that had lessened the longer the game endured. War had shattered something in him. The wars were a kind of shield, just large enough that maybe no one would notice him at all. And then there was a lull, right after the Russians and right before the Taliban, and he'd been given a task, and then he'd lost touch. He'd been hired, contracted to quietly retrieve manned portables, ballistic guns called Stingers, which the United States had handed out to the Mujahideen in its successful bid to defeat the Red Army. When his pleas of fellas, them guns was only loners, failed to work, he'd had to steal, trade, or pay for whatever he found. He was up against Iran and North Korea, and the democracy of fair market trade. The United States wasn't the only country interested in having the Stingers, and $150,000 was starting to look like a deal from the point of view of some of the owner's operators. Hell, it started to look like a deal to Michael, too. There were perks to being invisible. Some of the guns got lost in transit. Michael's bank accounts reflected net gains. Shit, in his darkest moments, he had thought, did it matter which asshole killed which other asshole, so long as he didn't die, so long as he got richer? And now here he was, about to die. Michael's hand hovered in space and then moved toward his weapon, another joke that would not help him if what he suspected was right. He wondered why Omar was smiling. You might be interested, Michael, who knows? Omar did a half turn and bolted the door shut behind him. Privacy, he said. Michael looked at Omar and realized he hadn't really seen him before. He'd spent the day with him and yet hadn't taken much notice of him. Omar was handsome and had features that would be described as dignified, aristocratic almost. He looked like he could be a diplomat, almost French-looking in his angularity. He had deep-set eyes and a pleased alertness to him. His nose ran thin and parallel in its slope to the plane of his face. He had beard stubble on his chin and a soft line of hair above his lip. No, Omar was best described as beautiful. He was smiling, and Michael smiled back. He found he could not look at Khalid. It would be better to die quickly without seeing the device the man would use. He did not need that information in the final analysis. He smiled too widely and tried to curtail his smile by saying, "What's he got to sell me right now, Omar? And why?" "He is poor and needs the money. Look, please." And Omar's beautiful long fingers waved in front of his eyes, and he followed their sweep to Khalid's belly. No belt, no explosives. Instead, a tattoo. It was fresh, he could see little droplet scabs. Urdu. It read right to left. "I am not a terrorist." And Michael looked up and saw that the boys were laughing at him. Omar was hitting Khalid playfully, and both boys were clearly pleased with the joke they had had on him. He was off guard. "Thank you."